I'm Paul Gordon, appearing on my own behalf and on behalf of my firm. I was retained to defend somebody who was being sued on a claim for quantum merit brought by a prior attorney. I spoke to him on the phone. I met with him in person. I reviewed the materials he could give to me. I read the file that was available on LexisNexis. And I spoke to an attorney about whether or not I could allege a malpractice as a defense to the quantum merit claim. And that attorney, who was qualified and familiar with the file, certified that I could. And so in defense of the quantum merit claim, and incidentally, in the form of a separate malpractice claim, we make the allegation that there was malpractice. Shortly thereafter, my client died. And it wasn't a surprise that he died. He had a terminal form of cancer. When he talked to me, he talked about the fact that he was dying and that there were certain specific things he wanted to keep confidential, not the least of which was the identity of the attorney who certified the malpractice claims.
Counsel, you say that he certified. That's not correct, is it? There was no certification here.
He certified it. What didn't happen is I didn't file a document that said I have talked to someone.
Well, a certification is by definition a signed document attesting to the truth of something. Was there such a certification? It's certainly not in the sealed submission you made to the court.
No, it was, and it would have been done by me, not the attorney. It would have been done by me, and no, it wasn't done.
So there was no certification by the expert here.
Those are, I'm not trying to split hairs, but they're two different things. The expert tells me that there was good faith basis for asserting malpractice. It would then be up to me to certify that I talked to the expert.
I understand that. A moment ago you said, and you say several times in your brief, that an expert certified, and that never happened, did it?
Yes, I think you're correct the way you're asking the question.
You had a conversation with him in which he said certain things.
Right. And it would have been up to me to certify, and I never filed a certification, and the only reason I didn't is because my client dies and the deadline runs out. You know, as a matter of practice, I now file certifications along with the complaint. At that time, I just wasn't doing it, and I don't know anybody who was doing it at that time, and I haven't seen anybody else do it since then. So the problem is that in the course of many of these discussions, I met with my client's wife, and it turns out she is not only not designated as the personal representative of his estate, she has claims against the estate. I'm quite familiar with those claims, and so I have a conflict of interest preventing me from representing the estate. So I've done everything I can. There were some additional incidental proceedings. I think I filed a motion for stay to give the estate a little more time to retain counsel. And then there were things that went on that I don't even know for sure went on. The estate eventually retains counsel, and I think the estate eventually negotiated a resolution with Mr. First. But all of that takes place without my involvement and without my knowledge. A year goes by, and Mr. First manages to resurrect a motion for sanctions against me. I look at the rules of ethics regarding the duty of confidentiality. They clearly say that and the case law clearly says that my duty of confidentiality survives his death. I even spoke to a representative of the estate. I can't remember if it was the attorney at that point. The attorney makes clear that I don't.
What you're saying now, is this in the record?
That part's not in the record.
Okay.
No, I was just.
Go on.
Okay. I do not get permission from anyone to disclose the confidential information. So I don't have authority to do it. So now the only issue is, can I do it to defend myself? And I don't think so. The rules regarding the duty of confidentiality are clear. I was not ordered to disclose this confidential information. And this attack is not being brought by my client, which is the usual circumstance in which I would have permission to disclose confidential information. This attack is being brought against by my client's adversary. And my interpretation of the rules is I can't disclose it. And
are you familiar with the comment 10 to rule 1.6 of the professional rules?
I'm sure I read it, but I can't tell.
Well, that's the comment that says you are entitled, you do have a right to disclose the information, even if the claim is brought by a third party against you.
That's true. But the rules also say that all the rules have to be considered in conjunction with each other. And the situation I'm in is I have to choose between disclosing this stuff and being accused of an ethics violation.
No, you wouldn't be, because as I understand the comment, says that you are free to disclose the information if it's necessary in order to defend yourself against a claim by a third party.
I just don't agree with that interpretation. I mean, even if the comment says that in no uncertain terms, the comment itself has to be read in conjunction with the other rules on the duty of confidentiality. And it's clear that the very purpose of the duty of confidentiality is to prevent your client's adversary from getting access to this information. So if I could just solve this problem by disclosing confidential information to my client's adversary, it fundamentally vitiates the purpose of the duty of confidentiality in the first place. It could even be circumvented simply by always making a motion for sanctions against opposing counsel, and then I could always say, well, I'm entitled to disclose my client's confidential information in response to this motion for sanctions. Therefore, the attack on the lawyer, in this case, Mr. First's attack on me, becomes the mechanism to defeat the duty of confidentiality. So even if the rule, even if a comment specifically says I can defend myself on a third party's claim, I don't think the rules interpreted as a whole permit me to defend myself in that particular way from an attack by my client's adversary, who is the very person for whom the duty of confidentiality is designed to prevent the disclosure.
So in such circumstances, is the lawyer always the pinata?
No, because there's a way out, and that's for me to disclose the information in camera.
But doesn't that deny your adversary the appropriate things like cross-examination and discovery that are normal, that normally accompany this kind of stuff?
Well, I have two responses to that. I'm not so sure that it's clear under the rules of procedure that in a motion for sanctions that you have the right to cross-examination, but let's assume that you do. Yes, you're right. It does deny that right to cross-examination, but there's a balancing that takes place, and the balancing that was contemplated in the rules of ethics and in the rules regarding certificates of review, both say that it's proper to submit the information in camera. So there are two different places where that's contemplated, and a balancing test has taken place, and the rules have said the proper procedure is to submit it for in-camera review.
Well, so, all right, that's one possible procedure. But there are others, aren't there? Couldn't another expert with whom there was no confidential relationship have been consulted in order to defend yourself? Couldn't you have brought somebody else in who said, yeah, I don't have this same problem about confidentiality. I didn't know Mr. Mattis, and I had no relationship with this case before, and I've looked at it, and Mr. Gordon had an appropriate good faith basis for bringing it.
I could have done that, and to some extent, you know, I could bring on a whole new trial, which is part of what I was getting at in the briefs. We're just going to try this case. But here are the factual, the evidence in the record. I testified. I'm an attorney, and I could testify to the things that I was permitted to testify to, which included the fact that there was evidence in the record that Mr. First had agreed to pay a referral fee, which is inappropriate in the state of Colorado. So the evidence that was actually given to the judge was sufficient to preclude a finding that there was no good faith basis for asserting the malpractice defense to the quantum merit claim. So, yes, could I have put on a whole show? Sure. I mean, at some point, I could have brought in the whole case that would have been contemplated in the first place. But the issue here was not whether we could prove by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. First was negligent. The issue here was there any evidence to support the making of the allegation? And there was evidence. Evidence that got presented at the hearing and was fundamentally unrebutted. I mean, Mr. First denies having agreed to pay a referral fee, but he doesn't deny the fact that he did all the work in the case and that Mr. Tyne ends up getting $25,000. That was enough evidence in the record to preclude a finding that the claims were groundless. And given the context of the hearing, which was a motion for sanctions, not a trial on the merit, that was a sufficient and appropriate way to respond to the motion for sanctions. It was sufficient and appropriate because, in addition to doing that, I also submitted information in camera for the court's review. I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Let me ask just a quick question, if I may. What was the damage that was caused, the harm for which you were suing for malpractice? What was the damage that resulted from this referral fee? What was the proximate harm that was caused your client as a result of this referral fee?
Okay, there were two different issues. There was the malpractice claim, and it would have been an argument for disgorgement of the referral fee, which is an element of damages for a breach of fiduciary duty.
And then it would have been because there was this unlawful referral fee arrangement, the fee was forfeit.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have 3 minutes and 59 seconds left.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Diane Smith, registration 14340, appearing on behalf of Bruce P. First Esk and Bruce P. First PC. Before I begin into the substance of the argument, I need to reframe the issues because I think there are some misunderstandings about how this case came about. First of all, Mr. First and Mr. Time represented Mr. Mattis. There was a fee agreement that laid out how they were going to divide the fees. That's in the record on appeal. Mr. Mattis and Mr. First and Mr. Tyne attended a settlement conference, and a document was drafted by their opponents that had terms in it that Mr. First could not agree to. As a result, he filed a motion to withdraw to Judge Tidball, who was hearing the case. She required him to make some changes to it, including to set forth the trial date and that it would not be changed by his withdrawal. He filed that. Mr. Mattis never objected to that withdrawal, and the judge granted the withdrawal. Mr. First assisted Mr. Mattis in finding replacement counsel, Mr. Dixon. Mr. Dixon and Mr. Tyne then continued forward with that case. Mr. First wasn't done. He appeared at trial, and he assisted Mr. Dixon in a number of areas. As a result, they got through to the last day of the trial, which was a Friday. On that date, the parties settled the case. The settlement funds were paid, and they were immediately disbursed. It was Mr. Dixon who paid $25,000 to Mr. Tyne for the work that he had done in the case. Mr. First received nothing for the work that he had done. Thereafter, he filed his petition for attorney's fees in accordance with Rule 121, Section 122. Now, here's where it gets a little dicey in terms of the facts which are actually in the record. The first pleading that's filed, the response to the petition, is filed by Mr. Mattis pro se. And what he says is he shouldn't have to pay the fees. Pretty much the sum and substance of it. And Mr. Gordon is retained, and Mr. Gordon files a response to the petition wherein what he says is the time spent was unreasonable and the hours spent were unreasonable. There is no assertion of a defense of client abandonment in that pleading. What happens is he tries to bring in all the other attorneys, Mr. Dixon and his firm, Mr. Tyne and his firm, and Judge Tidball says, wait a minute, that has nothing to do with the fee agreement between attorney and client. And she declines to allow that amendment to add those claims. And then the separate complaint for attorney malpractice is filed by Mr. Gordon, and it's filed against all of the attorneys that have represented Mr. Mattis at this point. And what it says as to Mr. First is you abandoned your client. It was negligent to abandon your client, and the client was damaged as a result of that. There's no mention of a secret referral fee. There's no mention of the fact that Colorado doesn't even recognize a claim for client abandonment as a basis for attorney malpractice, not in the context of this case where the court approves a petition to withdraw. So, we get about 50 days into the case, no certificate of review filed. Now, the certificate of review statute was adopted to preclude the filing of frivolous litigation because of the burden that that litigation places, not just on litigants, but on the trial courts themselves. The procedure is simple. You get somebody who's qualified to do a review, to examine all of the materials, and then you file your certificate. That's, I think, the distinction that you were making, Judge Miller. The expert makes a determination as to whether there's a good faith basis for the claim. The attorney files the certificate of review in accordance with the statute. Without that certificate filed, there is no evidence of certification. Because I said so does not accord with the requirements of the statute. Now, in this case, Mr. Gordon argues that because he says he consulted an expert and relied upon this otherwise undisclosed certification, that's sufficient to preclude a motion for sanctions for litigation lacking substantial justification. It's not enough. The case law, the Mitchell case, makes it clear that even if a certificate is filed, the litigation may still be lack substantial justification. That's Mitchell at 104 P. 3rd at 320. The other problem with this argument is not only is it inconsistent with the case law, it's inconsistent with the statute itself. If you look at the certificate of review statute, it contains an exception where there's a rebuttable presumption of good faith in the context of a certification applicable to a mental health, or I'm sorry, not a mental health, a medical professional. Some days it could be mental health, be that as it may. There is no similar rebuttable presumption for attorneys. What's more, it is only a rebuttable presumption. It's not irrebuttable. Under these circumstances, the record demonstrates why Mr. Gordon's argument has to fail. His claim and his affidavit were insufficient to defend against the claim of frivolous litigation. And that's because, by way of Judge Tidball's referral, when Mr. Gordon said, I've got this affidavit and it's confidential, she said, well, then I probably ought not see it. I'm going to send it down the hall to Judge Boatwright and ask him to look at it and have him decide whether it is sufficient to defeat the motion for sanctions. Judge Boatwright looked at it and he said, nope. As a matter of law, this is not enough to defeat the motion for sanctions. This needs to go to hearing. And he directed us to schedule a hearing. And the reason was that there were issues about credibility. Now, I haven't seen that affidavit. I don't know who the expert was. I don't know what his credentials were. I don't know any about that. But if I read Judge Boatwright's order, it appears to me that there's two credibility determinations at issue. One is Mr. Gordon's credibility. The second is the expert's credibility. And if it's a credibility determination, it has to be made by the finder of fact. And in that case, that was Judge Tidball. So we went to hearing. We get to the hearing, and Mr. Gordon doesn't want to present this expert because it's confidential. Okay. Where's the expert that says that the litigation wasn't frivolous? There's lots of experts out there. Nobody came. And so he offered, in fact, he tried to offer testimony about all the things that the expert had said, including the claim that this was a referral fee. And Judge Tidball, on my motion, said, I'm striking that evidence because it is a denial of the right of cross-examination. And Mr. Gordon admitted at the hearing, and here as well, that by keeping that information confidential, it did in fact work as a denial of the right of Mr. First's opportunity to cross-examine the expert. After hearing all of the evidence, I'm sorry?
I just want to ask a quick question. He testified at the hearing about the referral arrangement, and that was struck?
That was part of the testimony that was struck because it was based upon this undisclosed expert's opinion.
Is there any other evidence in the record regarding the referral fee agreement?
There is no evidence in the record, Your Honor. Now, the other part of this argument is Mr. Gordon's argument that under the statute, he only had to disclose the evidence, the identity of the expert in camera. That's based upon a partial reading of the statute. If you read the remainder of that part of the statute, what it says is that the litigant need not reveal the identity of the expert. It doesn't say shall not. It doesn't say can't be ordered to. It says need not. And the reason that becomes important is because specifically on cases like this, where it is the substance of the expert's testimony that becomes critical to deciding whether the litigation was properly certified, assuming there had been a certificate filed, or whether it was in fact frivolous, there has to be a mechanism whereby the expert's identity and opinions can be revealed. But in this case, the reason that didn't happen was because Mr. Gordon took the step of filing the motion to have it sealed, which was ordered by Judge Boatwright, also upon referral from Judge Tidball. So, a couple of other issues you didn't hear anything about in the opening that I would like to address. We get to the end of the hearing, and Judge Tidball says he didn't have any basis in law because he admitted there's no claim in Colorado for client abandonment under these circumstances, and there was never a defense of client abandonment that was asserted, but assume that we got to the hearing and she could still consider it, there simply was no evidence. That makes litigation frivolous. Now, I know Mr. Gordon has repeatedly said, oh, it's not groundless. Groundless needs a trial. We're not talking about groundless. Well, groundless never appears in Judge Tidball's decision. What she says is that the litigation lacked substantial justification because it had no basis in law or fact. That's the definition under Western Realty of frivolous litigation. You may have a theory, maybe, but when you get into the hearing context, there is no evidence. Now, Mr. Gordon's argued that the statute is unconstitutional. Setting aside the presumption that statutes are constitutional until proven to be unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, his argument has to fail there as well. He's asserting a First Amendment right to advocate on behalf of a client. But the case law makes it clear that even when First Amendment rights are involved, judicial immunity is not absolute for private attorneys, for non-governmental litigants. And even if you had some form of that, a First Amendment right itself is not absolute. The classic we all learn in law school, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Well, how does it chill a First Amendment right to advocate to say that an attorney is precluded from bringing frivolous litigation? There is no such law, not in this state and not anywhere else. Now, there is no evidence in this record to support the claim this was a good faith effort to expand or modify the existing law. In fact, when the original complaint was filed, we filed the motion to dismiss, and we said not only was the litigation frivolous as to Mr. Mattis, but the litigation was frivolous as to Mr. Gordon. He responded to that some time later and never said, oh, I'm trying to change the law.
Counsel, he did, I think at the hearing he said, oh, by the way, I filed this Rule 21 petition with the Supreme Court. I want to incorporate in that in the record. And there is a reference to making new law in that petition.
There is a reference to that, Your Honor. There is a bare reference to it, and the first time it's raised is when it's going up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declines to hear it. But there is never that assertion to the trial court judge so that she can consider it as part of her determination.
But I think he asked her to consider the petition as part of her decision making.
When we got to hearing. And at that point, you know, we're at 11 hours and 55 minutes to deciding whether there are going to be sanctions involved. With respect to the issue raised about whether the attorney's fees statute allows the imposition of a sanction against one's litigation adversary, first of all, case law makes it clear that yes, you can do that. You've got the Mitchell case and you've got the Parker case, cases where it recognizes that it is the attorney who decides how the claims go forward. how the case is filed. Clearly, the client is in charge of settlement. We all know that. But it's the attorney who makes the decision about the strategic matters involved in the case. So the courts have said, as a result, where you have the statutory language that says that the fees may be apportioned between the opposing attorney and the client, in both Mitchell and Parker, the court has said that it can be imposed against the opposing attorney. In the Mitchell case, in fact, the judge talked about, or the court talked about sanctioning the attorney because the attorney had joined in the client's holy war against the therapist who had issued a bad decision. Mr. Gordon also raised the question about whether a sanction motion has to be proven by a preponderance of the evidence versus clear and consenting evidence. The Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals decision starting in 1987 make it clear that the issue applicable to, or the burden of proof applicable to fee petitions is by a preponderance of the evidence. And there is nothing that deviates from that standard. With respect to his claim that there has to be some kind of a prima facie case made before you ever get to a hearing, well, that's not in Rule 121 as promulgated by the Supreme Court. More importantly, it wouldn't have helped any in this case. He had the opportunity to present all of this information to Judge Boatwright, and Judge Boatwright said, nope, you're going to hearing. Now, finally, he's claimed that his effort to protect his client is more important. May I have just a second to finish, Your Honor?
Finish your sentence.
Thank you. That his right is more important than Mr. First's right to be protected from frivolous litigation. But as the court explained in Parker, the duty of a lawyer to represent his client with zeal does not militate against his concurrent obligation to treat with consideration all persons involved in the legal process and to avoid the infliction of needless harm. That's what happened here. The trial court reached the right result, and we ask you to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Please.
There are three things that counsel just said that are just wrong. They're just errors in her understanding of the record. The first is Judge Boatwright did not rule that the content of the affidavit I filed was insufficient to overcome the motion for sanctions. What he said was that an affidavit was not the correct way to present that information because it denied the right to test my credibility. So I testified at the hearing, but nowhere does Judge Boatwright say that the substance of what was in the affidavit was inadequate to defeat the motion for sanctions. The second thing that is said is that when Judge Tidball struck evidence at the hearing, she struck the evidence of the referral fee. That is not correct. It's not correct. When you read the transcript, what she strikes is the content of what the expert said. But to the extent the expert commented on the referral fee, it was not the only evidence in the record. There was my testimony based on my own review of the file and my own conversations with Mr. Mattis that there was evidence of a referral fee. And perhaps the single most overwhelming evidence is the fact that Mr. First appears to have done all of the work in the case. Mr. Tyne didn't do anything, a fact that has never been denied. I'm frankly empathetic to Mr. First on this point because he did do all of the work, and there never should have been a payment of a fee to Mr. Tyne. The third error was the notion that the Judge Tidball relied on the argument of abandonment as a basis for the sanction. She clearly says, regardless of whether abandonment was a basis for the claim or not, and regardless of what abandonment means and whether it's recognized under Colorado or not, I'm finding a sanction for other reasons. So when you go back and read the hearing, this whole part about abandonment, whether that's the same thing of duty of diligence, it's irrelevant to the court's findings. Ultimately, I would like to make sure the court understands that Mr. Mattis is not represented in this hearing. It is his confidential information that needs to be protected. And he doesn't have a dog in this fight except vicariously through me and my responsibilities as an officer of the court. If you rule that my duty was to disclose this information, in all likelihood, what I have to do then is go back to the trial court under Rule 60B and say, okay, here's the confidential information. Let's relitigate it in the context of now. Now the court has said I should have disclosed this information. I'm now disclosing it, and let's have it out again. And it frankly concerns me when I stand in a courtroom, and I've had several opportunities in this case now to do that, and talk about whether I should be disclosing a deceased client's information when there are people standing behind me who might be thinking about, what do I tell my lawyer if I know that if I die suddenly, everything I tell my lawyer is subject to public knowledge, especially if my own adversary just brings a motion for sanctions against my lawyer. This is a substantial chilling effect on confidential communications with the lawyer. If this court rules that my duty was to disclose that information, it will have a substantial chilling effect on the attorney-client privilege. And on balance, this court should not reach that ruling and should reverse the sanction.
Counsel, didn't Mr. Mattis, when he filed the suit, bearing in mind all the people he sued, doesn't he have to live with the consequences of having done that and whatever waivers that entails?
He has to deal with the consequence of the waiver of the attorney-client privilege between him and those lawyers. But he doesn't have, he's not waiving the privilege as between him and me. And that's the content of the information that's at issue here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.